Thank you very much, and thank you for coming today. In 2011, the creative economy enjoys a place of prominence on the national agenda. Compelling ideas and engaging media generate more jobs than ever before. From breaking news to breakthroughs in science, from blockbuster films to bloggers in basements, the value of intellectual property is paramount. Yet online, digital files and their copies can be made and distributed with a single click. In an environment where many believe that information wants to be free, authors, creators, and publishers must struggle to assert their ownership, to assert ownership of their works. This occasion marks the 35th anniversary of the Copyright Act of 1976, when Congress took into account how television, radio, sound recordings, and other then-cutting-edge innovations like the photocopier had wrought unimaginable change since the previous legislation in 1909. Once again, we turn to Congress to shape laws and regulations that will protect intellectual property in the digital age. So many concerns present themselves. Are search engines like Google and other content aggregators benefiting from the labor and investment of others? Are copyright owners pushing for too much control over the use of their content? Is copyright law ever going to catch up with technology, and should it? Our panel today is a distinguished one. Mary Beth Peters, U.S. Register of Copyrights from 1994 to 2010, John Baumgarten, a lawyer, intellectual property lawyer and partner at Proskauer, and Tim Jacoby, associate counsel at the Washington Post here, and we're very grateful, Tim, because Catherine Weymouth is unable to be here due to a family medical emergency, and our moderator, Chris Keneally from Copyright Clearance Center. Again, thank you, and I'll turn it over to Chris.
Well, thank you very much, Tracy, and again, a warm welcome to everyone here in the museum and watching us on live streaming on our website, copyright.com. We decided to call this program Copyright and Commerce. It's a neat little phrase that gathers up a lot of great discussion points, and I'm looking forward to trying to discover where the intersection between copyright law and business and Congress all meet. And I think it's a great place to do it here in Washington. And no better person to turn to first, she knew I was going to do that, to Mary Beth Peters. Mary Beth, welcome.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you join us here. Your name was synonymous with copyright for a number of years. And before we get into the real serious discussion, I have to ask you a question. Are you enjoying retirement?
Mostly, yes. Some days I don't feel retired.
You're keeping busy then?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great. Well, you know, everyone these days is fond of quoting the Constitution, so I thought we might start by doing that. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8. Would you recite it for us?
I don't know if I recite it. I'll paraphrase it for you. This is the article in the Constitution that's very important to every copyright lawyer in the United States. It's the clause that basically gave to Congress the power to grant exclusive rights to authors for limited times. And it is to encourage science, it also says in the useful arts. Science is knowledge. Science is the part of the Constitution that relates to authors. Useful arts is the patent piece. So we have Congress at the center, basically in charge of putting in place copyright laws for the benefit of society, that's the knowledge part, and science, for limited times. We can talk about limited times, but exclusive rights.
Well, you know, the phrase that I wanted to zero in on was that notion of the promotion of progress of science and the useful arts. Why would Congress, why would government want to be involved in promoting science and art?
Well, they certainly should be involved in promoting knowledge and also useful arts in a country that is just now being formed. And they learned from England about the importance of copyright, the first Copyright Act, 1710, in the United Kingdom, and we sort of copied that. But what the four founders of this country recognized, that in order to have a great country, you really have to incentivize people who are talented, people who are creative. And the whole purpose of being creative, or in the patent system with the useful arts, is for the benefit of society. So it wasn't real. They looked at other systems. You know, the church used to basically, you know, commission pieces. They looked at how people earned their livings in the creative arts, and they decided that this is the way to go. Empower Congress for the benefit of the people of the United States.
For the public good. Well, given, let's fast forward to 2011, right?
Yeah.
And given the stress that Tracy Armstrong alluded to, that's, you know, copyright holders of all kinds feel today, is the government doing enough?
I am no longer with the government.
For the record.
Enacting laws is always extremely difficult. And I think if we focus on Congress and the power of Congress, and I'll recognize that the Copyright Office and the Patent and Trademark Office and other people in the United States government work very, very hard day in, day out, looking out for authors and copyright owners. But for Congress, it's a very difficult task. Today, as Tracy mentioned, we have all kinds of new devices. We have all kinds of ways in which content is distributed, not just to people in the United States, but around the world. It doesn't have to be put in paper, and it can be sent out in perfect form instantaneously throughout the world. What's happened over the years is there were always authors, and then there were publishers. And then, of course, there was educational material, and there were libraries, and there were a wide variety of people who cared about copyright. But today, almost everybody cares about copyright. Certainly the consumer does. The consumer basically weighs in loud and clear with regard to certain copyright issues. So if you're a member of Congress today, I believe that members identify with authors, they identify with publishers, but they also identify with their constituents and with consumers, with electronics companies and technology companies. They have a lot of people who are in front of them trying to tell them what is the best way to move forward with the copyright law. So I think it's a harder task today, if you're a member of Congress, to basically get back straight. And I don't know that in today, with all the issues that are before them, that they have the time that they used to have to consider things, you know, more leisurely. So, yeah, I think Congress probably could do a better job, and maybe the rogue website legislation will be introduced today, and that's a positive step. But I do think it's a hard job. But that's why the people who are here today, and that's certainly why I stay involved, because I really do believe that we do have to have laws that recognize the issues of today, and that getting the proper balance is critical.
One of the things that I think has changed copyright forever is just you were alluding to. It was a day before the digital era when copyright was pretty much the concern of, besides attorneys like John, it was the concern of authors and publishers and some film studios and recording labels. Today, everyone is a copyright holder.
Yes, and a user.
Right. And that's it's you're of two minds. At one point, you want to just make stuff and distribute it. On the other hand, if you've created a terrific new, you know, web video or something like that, you want to realize the potential of it.
That's absolutely true. But in the end, it's up to Congress and up to the people in this room to make sure that we get the copyright laws that we deserve. And I identify clearly with authors and those who take their rights through authors. I also, of course, care about a balanced policy. So one of the things I am doing in retirement is working on those issues.
Okay. Well, you know, while you were in office, there were a number of reforms that took place.
Yes.
So now that you're not in office, I'm going to ask you, what are the ones you're proud of, and is there anything you might regret?
Let's start with proud.
Please start there.
Let's start with proud. Actually, I was with the Copyright Office for more than 45 years, but in my tenure as being head of the Copyright Office, there were so many challenges dealing with new technology. And I testified before Congress on many, many occasions, sometimes successfully. Sometimes they thanked me very much and thought I had great ideas, but didn't come to light, and sometimes they didn't agree, and that's part of what they do. I think if I look at what I'm proudest of, it's hard to pick out one. Not that the Act really works very well today, but it proved a concept. When the Digital Millennium Copyright Act went into play, because we had two new treaties that we really wanted to adhere to, and it became kind of a Christmas tree for a variety of digital objects.
This was in the late 90s.
This is 1997, 1998 when it finally passed. One of the things that there were a few provisions put in for libraries, not rightly, but they got in there. But education was left out, and we really did work on getting something called the Teach Act. Now, the reality of the Teach Act is too complicated for anyone to use, so that's a very big negative. The positive side is Congress recognizing that they hadn't dealt with balance in the digital and online digital environment, and that they needed to, and they put in place a process. If you were doing it today, you probably would change the process. And I look out at Steve Tepp, and he was working on the Teach Act, and he got a call at 5 o'clock at night saying, we're sending over the members, and could you have somebody work with them on starting this process? And Steve volunteered and was there till about midnight. And that started a process. But I'm proud that Congress recognized it. I'm proud they looked to the Copyright Office to do it. I'm proud of the people who work in the Copyright Office and the litigation, not just legislation, but the litigation that we were involved with and basically helped make the courts understand what the issues are and come to decisions that I think better the policy and certainly serve authors and copyright owners well.
What about taking anything back?
Taking anything back. God, I don't know that I want to say I want to take anything back. It was what it is. You learn from it and you move on.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because we're going to talk about a variety of ways that Congress and the copyright holders have looked at reform over time. And I guess it's always a matter of an evolution and where people try to catch up with technology, try to do the right thing, and then find out whether it's the right thing later.
Yeah,
that's tough.
That is tough. And what's interesting, when I look back, and John was much more involved in it than I was, when the 1978 law was put into place, people remember the gentlemanly discussions, the compromises that were reached. And if you go back and read all the legislative history, that's true. In the beginning, the parties came together, the Copyright Office was central, there were studies, there were discussions, there were compromises that were reached. And about 1965, you have a bill that's introduced that reflects where people are, and then you have the standout issues, almost all of which deal with technology. Photocopying, cable television. And those issues became bitter, were hard fought, and eventually the parties got together because Congress wanted to get moving. And they said to the parties, you either work out a solution or we'll work it out for you. That's a great incentive.
It focuses the mind.
It focuses the mind. But it really shows that even in an era where people look back at people were gentlemanly and they spoke and there weren't all the interest involved, when it came to technology and some issues, it really was a very hard-fought battle. And the things that were put in place, cable, it's still around without too many adjustments, though we keep recommending adjustments, with library photocopying. That's not the technology of today. That's a part of the law that really does have to be updated. The process is a hard one.
Right. Well, there's a case that no one could have envisioned in 65 or 78 or maybe even in 97, which your office took a strong position on, and it's still an open question today, and that was the Google Book settlement.
And you can laugh because I took a strong position.
Well, that's right. And I wonder if for people who might not be familiar, just if you could characterize what your position was, and how do you feel now that Judge Chin has ruled in rejecting the proposal?
Okay, let's start with the Copyright Office is part of the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress was one of the places that Google went to digitize their books. And it was.
What did you say when they asked?
Well, they didn't ask me first. They didn't ask me first. And so what happened was there were people in the library who thought it was a good thing, and they said, well, maybe you should ask Mary Beth in the copyright office. And Mary Beth said, well, I think we have a little bit of a problem here. Google is relying on fair use. You're going to copy absolutely everything. It doesn't matter whether it's a brand new book or an old book, whether it's a work of entertainment, whether it's a research work. No, the copyright office recommends to the librarian that only public domain works should be part of the endeavor between the library and Google. And Google decided that that wasn't good enough, and they walked away. But at that time, I heard from a chief executive officer named Schmidt, who basically said to a group from the copyright office, you know, copyright should be an opt-out system. We get to use it unless you opt out. And as I saw this go forward, I said, I recognize this scenario.
What would that mean? Just explain for people who might not be familiar.
Remember,
now is opt-in. Why would it be opt-out?
It's Congress basically gives the right to authors. They are their rights. So they own them. And if you want those rights, you have to go to the copyright owner. That's the copyright system, if you need permission. There are plenty of exceptions. If, in fact, it flips and it's you get to use it unless the copyright owner objects to it, that's a very different system. That's the system that I strongly object to.
That's what you were calling copyright standing it on its head.
Yes, I did use that phrase.
Well, how do you feel now that Judge Chin has ruled? He said specifically that a lot of the issues involved in the case weren't for the courts, they were for Congress. So to take you back to that question.
He said that the orphan work issue, there is an issue with regard to books, which is less than it is with regard to other types of works, in finding the copyright owner in order to get permission. That piece is a small piece of the Google Book settlement. Congress almost enacted legislation. I thought it probably was fairly close. With regard to Google Books, Google got to use orphan works without searching for them. So it's that piece where the judge said that's for Congress. With regard to the other parts of it, he basically said you went too far. You didn't just solve the problems that were at issue in the case, which was scanning, reproducing the works, and showing snippets. You created new business models for the future. That is too far. That's the part that I applaud in Judge Chin's decision, while recognizing that many, many good things were in that settlement, and we have to wait and see whether the parties will come up with a new settlement or what happens as we move forward.
And if I recall correctly, he also referred to the potential for an opt-in solution.
Yes. From the very beginning, we said, of course, if you have a settlement and it doesn't bind you unless you opt in, then you are giving permission through that opt-in system. So, of course, from the very beginning, I said it, as did others, opt-in was a solution. Google representatives repeatedly said that doesn't give us enough works to be in the base for it to be useful.
Well, finally, let me ask you, Mary Beth, about the potential value. You spoke about copyright law and the Constitution as being, you know, for the public good. Talk briefly about the value of book digitization from your perspective.
I strongly believe in the part of the Constitution that talks about the benefit of the people. I believe we are in a digital world. I believe that digitization is a good thing. I believe that it's good that libraries are digitizing their collection as long as they follow copyright laws. I do believe that some of the work is in the public domain. I do believe that some of the digitization may be covered by an exception. And I do believe that there's a big other piece that's there that requires licenses. And so, therefore, all of that is part of the solution. It's not digitizing. You digitize, you follow the law.
All right. Well, Mary Beth Peters, thank you very much. We'll pause just a moment to remind everybody watching us online on copyright.com that if you have questions for our panel, we'll be taking that through our Twitter feed, which is @copyrightclear, all one word. And today we're talking about copyright and commerce. And I want to turn now to John Baumgarten, and let me start, John. First of all, welcome.
Thank you.
And I'll read from an abbreviated list of precedent-setting cases where you've made your mark: Texaco, Kinko's, Napster. You were also the general counsel of the Copyright Office when the 1976 Act was written and passed. We've alluded to it. At that point in 1976, the great disruptive technology was the photocopier. It must seem rather quaint. It must seem rather quaint at this point.
I expected that response.
What's a photocopier is probably what half the people in the room are wondering.
What people, and there's a few of you who remember, and I'm looking at photocopying technology was a major disruption. It wasn't the first disruptive technology in copyright. It wasn't the first encounter between copyright and technology. Many people feel copyright was born in new technology, the invention of the printing press. But photocopying, together with some off-air audio recording, was perhaps the first really major disruptive user-based technology that occurred in copyright. And the hallmarks of photocopying you recognize today in digital technology. Copying became decentralized. It was done everywhere, by everyone. It was cheap, it was simple, it was easy. You didn't have to own a factory or a plant to reproduce inexpensive copies of works. For generations, copyright owners, in point of fact, were protected by tedium as much as they were by law. It was hard to make a copy of something.
That's true.
Photocopying destroyed that tedium. The photocopier became the digital photocopier. The digital photocopier became the scanner. That became the route to the internet. So perhaps because I'm so in love with the Texaco case, everything traces back to photocopy. But it did exhibit a great number of issues that we now face with digital technology. Copyright Clearance Center, who's hosting us today, was born out of the attempt of copyright owners and copyright users, libraries, publishers, to mediate the new technology. And I think it does tell us a lot of things about where copyright may be headed, even though the technology itself is rather prosaic today.
Well, I guess that's the point. And you've written about this. And your assertion is that digital doesn't make that much difference when it comes to the law.
I've never asserted it that forcefully. And I'm also beginning to wonder more about what I have asserted. I think there is something. Obviously, there are some things about digital technology which take the impact of technology to a place they've probably not been before in my generation. But I don't think that answers anything. It just tells you that you may have a larger problem in some aspects than one had before, but it doesn't say some of the solutions that emerged before can't be reached. The reaction of many technologists, as Mary Beth suggested with Google, for example, is copyright is just in the way. The promise of new technology is so wonderful, so great, so fantastic, that anything in the way has to fall by the wayside. This is not the first time we've heard that. It hasn't been true in the past. And whether in the courts or Congress or in the intervention of the private sector, there can be solutions found that don't junk the system but deal with the problems. Just saying we have a vastly different technological revolution than we had before is just a statement. It doesn't tell you anything.
Well, you were involved in the work that took place to get the Copyright Act of 1976 written and then passed. Mary Beth was reminiscing about the very polite way everybody went about that.
In the beginning.
Is your recollection is your recollection quite so rosy as hers?
Yes,
I'm
and
older.
And I was involved in much of that, first in New York and then in Washington, and it wasn't quite so gentle. I can think of some episodes that one would not characterize that way. But it was different. The debate then was more civil. People tolerated each other more. There's a lot more trust. I've spent much of my career debating with librarians, which sometimes I feel, you know, and I represented publishers for many years. Why did I spend a career arguing between publishers and librarians? It doesn't make a lot of sense. But there was a lot. It was more civil, more trustful. The debate, the public debate, in the last decade or two has gotten very loud, very little trust. And I think that's what's different. But the public perception isn't always the truth. I mean, the motion picture studios and the electronics industry and the computer industry have been publicly at each other's throats for years. But behind the scenes, they sat together in a room. I represented the studios, others represented the computer industry, and others represented the consumer electronics industries. And the result of those discussions was DVD, probably the most successful electronic entertainment revolution in our lifetimes. So there are good things that happen. And if people listen to each other rather than scream at each other, there can be solutions.
All right, well, let's take that further. So this notion of trust, you think, is the most important piece, and Mary Beth's nodding. We'll take that up with you in a moment. But how would you, in today's environment, in 2011, on the Hill, try to promote that sense of trust that would get us to some
reforms?
I can't
promote it. It's for the players to promote it.
But if you could wave a wand, is there some way of looking at the issues that they're just ignoring right now that would help them to get to that point?
No, I don't think so. I think it's the Hill can't force, the Hill can force people to sit in a room together. They can't force them to trust each other and to stand by their word. That has to come from the participants. If I had to wave a magic wand, I would probably wave it over other problems in society.
But you are involved in something called the Copyright Principles Project, right?
Yes.
Which is looking seriously at all of these issues, which has issued some statements about what directions copyright reform may go. Tell us, what are some of the important points there?
Well, the copyright, let me say something brief about the Principles Project, because it's been widely misunderstood. The Principles Project went on for 2 or 3 years. A relatively large, but universally small group of people, mostly representing what copyright people call the copy left, or the low protectionist movement, but some of us representing the high protectionist movement, sat in a room at periodically for a few years and did listen to each other and did trust each other, I think, and reviewed many of the major issues. And we didn't come to a lot of unequivocal agreement. Unfortunately, the report of the Principles Project has been portrayed as something it's not, and people who read the report will see on several pages that it's not, but unfortunately, it used the term recommendations, which connoted a universality of agreement among the participants that wasn't really there, but there was a lot of listening. And I can look at pages in the report that reflect things that would have been said differently had somebody not listened to me, or things that I would have asked to be said differently had somebody not listened, had I not listened to them. Among the major themes of the report are, there is a movement towards something called reformalization of copyright.
Can you define that?
Copyright used to be a system in this country only, almost only in this country, which was immersed in formalities. You had to use a particular symbol someplace on the work. You had to register. You had to renew. If it were a book or a certain graphic art, you actually had to manufacture it in the United States or lose copyright protection. This was a so-called formalized copyright regime. In later years, copyright in this country has been largely deformalized. You don't have to use the symbol. You can register for certain benefits. But it's not a condition of maintaining your copyright. You don't have to manufacture in the United States, and so on. There is now interest among some proponents of this perspective in reformalizing copyright. The concern is that it's so easy for users to use works, and in the mashup culture, so valuable, according to this theory, that we should facilitate it. that we should use a reformalization system to separate the copyright wheat from the copyright chaff. I'm not a proponent of that. Mary Beth and I go back to the old system where people suffered considerably from it. My concern about the reformalization system is if we're going to separate the wheat from the chaff, you know, who makes the decisions? And if there are going to be benefits to registration or something else, then that means there are going to be detriments to not doing it. What's the nature of those detriments? And most importantly, how is that going to play out internationally? American copyright owners today are very fortunate. If you write a book, make a motion picture, draw a picture, you are protected almost throughout the world without doing anything. And it's always been like that outside the United States. If we start creating a new formalities regime here, will it be used by other countries as an artificial way to impair or negate protection of American works abroad? And that's one of the concerns, for example, that I expressed in the report. There are other aspects of the report that I feel more positive about. There is an encouragement for Internet service providers to deploy technological solutions to copyright problems. At the current time, at least the way it's coming out in the courts so far, although there are major issues arising in the Ninth and Second Circuit's Court of Appeal in the immediate future, ISPs don't have to do very much to protect copyright owners. They get a takedown notice, they take it down. There's an interest in the copyright community in the adoption by service providers of things like filtering technologies or others that can deal more efficiently with the problems. The Principles Project is sort of a general favorable endorsement of the notion of service provider deployment of technologies with gradations. Some of us felt that it should be mandatory. Others felt that it should be an induced but non-mandatory system. And there are a variety of other things the report talks about.
You were referring to the takedown process that's part of DMCA. And in a statement, I believe, in support of this bill that Mary Beth referred to on rogue sites and parasites and all that sort of thing, Brian Napack from Macmillan talked about how his company has to issue 3,000 takedown notices a month to the various ISPs. And it sounds like a tremendous burden. Is that how you see it? For the copyright holder to have to do that?
I don't have firsthand experience in implementing a plan, so I tend not to speak about things I don't have firsthand experience with, but I imagine there would be versions of copyright owners to do that. But I think it's important to point out that copyright owners, by and large, don't reject something just because it's burdensome. They just want something that equitably shares the burden on both sides. And in the Napster case, a lot of the judge's discussion was about how do you share these burdens. If you have a filtering technology deployed by the ISPs, somebody has to supply the information about what should be filtered out, which should be the copyright owners. If there's going to be a fingerprinting system, somebody has to supply the fingerprints. So, yes, there are burdens, and there are going to be burdens continuously, and again, it's the process of reaching a balance.
Right. So finally, that reform, if we ever were to get there, ought to be bidirectional, in your view.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm not sure the way things are going, we're going to get there in Congress, though. I mean, I've been fortunate in my history. We've been successful in a number of major litigations, which has affected the development of copyright law. And frankly, the courts are a more blunt way of dealing with it in Congress. But sometimes it's the only choice, and in our experience, it's worked rather well.
Well, John Baumgarten, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to take a moment again to remind people, if you are watching us on the live streaming on copyright.com, that you're welcome to tweet any questions for the panel to our Twitter feed, which is @copyrightclear. And now I'd like to introduce Tim Jacoby of The Washington Post. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, we talked about the Constitution at the beginning of the program. Well, there's a few other lines in the Constitution that matter to you and to The Washington Post, and that's, of course, the First Amendment, which this museum is a shrine to, in fact. And I went to an exhibit just yesterday at the National Portrait Gallery with wonderful photographs of Katharine Graham. And that woman's life's work was around the First Amendment, of course. So I'd like to start by asking you how, as a newspaper publisher, you see perhaps if there's a tension or how one seeks a balance between the protection you get from the Copyright Clause and the protection you get from the First Amendment.
Yeah, well, I think there's both a tension and a synergy there. You know, on the one hand, you know, we do need to be careful about laws that restrict speech, of course. But at the same time, and I'm stealing this from the Supreme Court, you know, the Copyright Clause is it's the economic engine that really drives speech. And if we didn't have copyright protection, you know, we would lose our economic incentive to go out there and report and create speech. So I think that, you know, we do need to be careful about going too far. But at the same time, it's, you know, our copyright protection is really critical to us.
Right. And, you know, I know that the Washington Post as a newspaper is also now, you know, one of its jobs is to be a technology innovator. There's a wonderful video, which I hope people have seen. If you haven't, you should look for it, where Bob Woodward and Ben Bradley confront this great new device called the iPad. It's a lot of fun to watch, and my favorite line is at the end when Ben says something like, these kids, they think these tweets tweet themselves. You know, it's terrific. But you, as a newspaper, need to be innovating and pushing the boundaries. Even calling it a newspaper these days is a bit of a misnomer. We've heard John and Mary Beth talk about this other tension between copyright and technology. Can you speak to that, how it looks from inside the Washington Post, and then we'll talk about how it feels to have it come at you?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking when John was talking about the tedium issue and how tedium was a great protection against copyright infringement so that, you know, once the photocopier came along, it was so easy to reproduce. And I think with digital, you see, you know, there was still some tedium protection with respect to distribution. It was, you know, still extremely hard to distribute. Now, all of a sudden, you have the reproduction, but you also have just the incredible ease of mass-scale distribution, you know, and more with mobile and tablets. So that's, I think, right now where the central tension comes in, you know, with technology and copyright protection.
Right, and the newspapers unfairly have been accused of not keeping up with technology enough. But again, I think the case is that these companies are trying their hardest. And yet, so as much as you're trying to push out new technology, it's coming at you. And you were just involved in a case, not so much a case in court, but a situation that I think is a great example of that. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there was an iPad app that was launched a few months ago called Zeit, which when it appeared, and it's a good-looking app, but what they would basically do is take content, full content from a number of publishers, hundreds, probably thousands of publishers, and repackage, reformat the content into the app, strip out advertising, and then serve the content, you know, in an aggregated way. So you could, you know, sign up for a feed about business information, and you get full articles from our business section and the Times business section, and, you know, hundreds of other business sections and business publications. So, you know,
all of this done without asking you so much as to buy your leave.
Right, exactly. So we didn't, you know, all of a sudden the app appeared one day, no permission up front. And again, I think, you know, what happened there, coming back to what Mary Beth said and talking about the Google Books settlement, it was the app was developed from the perspective of, oh, we'll take an opt-out approach. You know, if companies, publishers are not happy with the way their content's having their full content displayed on our app, we'll be happy to take them off. So we and a group of other publishers and content creators, 10 of us, jointly sent a letter to Zeit, basically explaining the problem with the opt-out approach, you know, and saying, look, we invest collectively hundreds of millions of probably billions of dollars in content creation. And, you know, when you sort of sit there and gather all of our full content together in a way that provides it to readers worldwide, but where we get no economic or really any other benefit at all, that's a problem. And we love the technology, we love innovation, but the point is, you know, you have to come to us first.
Well, what kind of reaction do you get when you tell these companies that? Do they act surprised as if they've never heard of copyright?
Well, I think the Zeit CEO actually said, you know, we thought this might happen. I think.
But it didn't bother him all that much.
No, I mean, that's really what's interesting, you know, and I actually, the last time I checked, they, you know, they did, and the response from the company was, you know, we'll change the way we display you so that we'll provide a short text blurb and then we'll link to your website. And they did that for all of the companies on the letter. The last time I checked, they had not done that for any other company, any other publisher that wasn't on the letter, which, you know, I think is interesting. And it underscores, you know, sort of, I think the law is there. I mean, it's clearly an infringing use of our content, but there's no fear. There's no, you know, there's no fear of repercussion. It's just, okay, go ahead. We'll, you know, we'll change the way we format you. We're not going to worry about getting hit with damages. We're not going to worry about the potential economic impact of what we're doing. And, you know, the big problem from the perspective of a publisher, a content creator, of an opt-out approach is that if we alone want to opt out, that's great, but it puts us at a commercial disadvantage, because if we opt out, there's no, as one publisher, one content creator, you know, we like to think, I mean, our content, you know, is excellent, but we're, you know, you lose the Washington Post from an app, the app can probably go on. And, you know, we're sort of just left out of that picture.
Right. Well, you know, aggregation is one of the hallmarks of the web. And so I have to ask you about how the Post and other newspapers you speak to feel about sites like Google News or the Huffington Post. What's the take on that?
So without getting into specifically how we feel about the Huffington Post or Google News, I mean, I will say that basically the thinking is sites that drive us traffic are ways, uses of our content by third parties in ways that drive us traffic, we like. You know, uses of our content by third-party sites in ways that serve as a substitute for having people come to our own original content is a problem for us, basically. So, you know, I think when there's ways to provide excerpts of our content and link to us that, you know, the data shows people do click through. And then there's ways to display excerpts of our content and provide a link that the data shows people don't click through, that they read it as a, you know, they read it as a substitute. And I think it gets trickier when you think about mobile, because are people, you know, when people are reading the news on mobile, are they just, do they really want just headlines, or do they want full, what are they, you know, what are they looking for? But that's really the paradigm. We like it. You know, it's good, I think it's good for content creators. Any use of our content that promotes people coming back and reading the original, that's good. Any use of our content that serves as a substitute for coming to us is a problem.
Well, let me ask you finally, Tim. I mean, you know, I'm an old newspaper man myself, and to come here to the museum to walk by all the front pages displayed, doesn't it seem like a simpler time, and don't you wish sometimes to go back to the days when the only thing to worry about was the front page?
I mean, it's amazing just that in the past year or two how much things have changed in the newspaper industry from that perspective, and how many more technology, you know, I mean, the tablets are, you know, a year, probably about a year, right? So it's nice, but I think the front page will be around for a long, long time. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. I think we're seeing that in our numbers too right now. So, but you know, it's at the same time, the fact that more and more people than ever buy, you know, exponentially more are reading our content is fantastic, and we love that. And the key is to just make sure that we are getting appropriate, you know, proportionate benefits for all the work that we're putting into our content and that everybody's reading.
Well, Tim Jacoby of The Washington Post, thank you very much. And again, I'll just remind our audience online that if you have any questions for our panel, and also remind our audience here at the museum, a nice crowd, if you have a question, we'll invite you up in just a few more minutes to ask it of the panel. And if you are online, the way to do that is to send a direct message to our Twitter feed at Copyright Clear. And, you know, I want to continue the discussion and see if we can get something sort of going here with the various panelists. And Mary Beth, you were speaking at the beginning about your retirement, and you've got some causes you were telling
yes.
me about. Can you share with us what those causes are?
Well, one of the things is I joined the board of the Copyright Clearance Center because I believe in licensing. And I'm doing some teaching and I'm doing some public speaking. But I want to, on causes that I believe in, which is about authors and making copyright work, be available. I just don't want to overcommit and feel like I'm really working again.
Well, exactly. let me ask you, John, about something I'm curious to your take on. You were talking about copyright reform and being bidirectional. What should copyright reform, if it ever happened? We're sort of imagining a scenario that we're not even sure will ever take place. But if copyright reform happened, is it to remember that first charge to promote progress? Is that what it's about, or is it to protect legacy companies? What should the copyright reform try to push us towards?
That's a fair question. The constitutional clause that Mary Beth paraphrased has always been read in sort of two different ways depending upon your mindset. Since it unquestionably says that there is a purpose to copyright and lays out what that purpose is, there is a school of thought that every issue must be addressed in terms of whether this particular case, this particular contract, this particular practice, or this particular debate issue addressed in Congress promotes or does not promote. The other school of thought is you can't do that on an item-by-item basis. So you have to trust in the entirety of the copyright system to promote progress of science and useful arts. And if you apply it on a case-by-case, court-by-court system, it's a little easier for Congress to do. Who's the decision-maker again? Who decides that this particular work promotes the progress of science, but this one doesn't? Fortunately, years ago, the Supreme Court had to deal with a circus poster, and the argument was made, well, this, come on, it's a circus poster. What does that have to do with promoting anything? And the Supreme Court stated that's not the job of judges. So the other issue that's fought out over the clause sometimes is, what's primary? Is it primary to encourage authors and write and composers and lyricists and directors and artists? Is that more important than promoting the progress of science and useful arts, or less? And which is primary, the purpose or the way you accomplish the purpose? And we'll be debating that for years as well. They're supposed to work in synergy. I don't know what the optimum result is. I do believe that the digital technology and the artifacts of it have changed things in the ways that I've not experienced before, that there may have to be innovative solutions that haven't emerged yet, that the intervention of private sector organizations, whether private sector registries to deal with the mashup problem or private sector licensing bodies like the Copyright Clearance Center and others. I don't have that magic wand to tell you what mix of copyright reform is going to work, if there will be reform in Congress. There's going to be fundamental decisions in the courts. I don't want to say reform because it depends on how the courts come out, whether you view it as reform or regression. But there are going to be major issues addressed in the Congress, in the courts, and internationally, which we tend to have ignored a bit in this discussion, which is a major impact given the world markets of U.S. copyright owners and the emergence of the United States as a market for non-American copyright owners. I just don't know where it's going to come out.
Well, Tim, what about for the Washington Post? Is doing nothing the best solution right now? You'd rather keep it in your hands. You can make the innovations you want and do the different ways of delivering the content that you decide and have the courts and even Congress stay out of it?
I mean, I think that the content creators and the developers and the platform manufacturers, you know, we all need to be on the same page. And whatever the vehicle is that gets us to the same page is, you know, it doesn't really matter to me. But we would love to be talking to the developers in the West Coast and talking to the software companies and talking to hardware companies and figuring out what uses of content are appropriate from our perspective and good enough from their perspective, because I understand that there's an overwhelming business interest and desire that could, and ultimately benefit to the public from broader and more creative ways to use and distribute content and copyrighted material. But I think the key, one of the ways that Congress can be so beneficial and that you guys were talking about is it can, you can get people in a room together who wouldn't normally get in a room together. Litigation can do the same thing, right? And I'm not sure litigation or legislation is the answer here, but I do think that getting people in a room together and saying, look, we understand that you guys want to be out here innovating all the time and putting our content on different devices in different ways and making it as the user experience is as easy and as global as possible. And we understand that, but there's got to be some ground rules here.
Right. We call the program Copyright and Commerce. And what's interesting is that, so we have the creative economy today, which is so fundamental to the American economy and to our global presence, not just as a profit generator, but as a way to sort of establish a kind of cultural heritage for this country. And then we have the other piece of the economy, which is increasingly a technology-driven economy, software and so forth. And John, you talked about the tension there and these innovators sort of coming along. The one that you were involved with at Napster, Sean Fanning, he never imagined what the consequences would be. Couldn't have.
Just to set the record straight, we did not have the role in the Napster case that we had in some of the other litigations. We had more of a specialized role dealing with certain aspects of the case. The technology is fascinating. Two things that Tim said, which is so typical of what happened with Napster, what's happened with Google, with YouTube. First, Tim said there was no fear. And that's, the attitude, particularly during the bubble years, or is it bubbly years? technology bubble years was, take first and deal with it later. Take somebody else's property, get your IPO, and then there'll be plenty of money around to sell it. And that hasn't gone away. And I don't have to label the companies that engage in that practice, although I think I just did it for a second. The second is very intriguing. You referred to the attractively formatted apps. I can't tell you the amount of times I've sat down and we've tried to draft a complaint about a new technology. And you sit there and you draft, you look at the draft and say, my God, this thing is really cool. The judge is just going to love this. How are we gonna... And I want one. But a serious vein, that's attracting consumers too. The technology is really, really cool. And the third roundabout answer to your question is, again, referring to Tim's point about the distribution problem has continued. In some ways, yes, it's much easier to distribute what you've taken from somebody else today. But one of the things, and again, forgive me, it started with photocopying. It also happened in audio recording. And it's happening very much with digital technology today, is you don't need distribution. Everybody is their own maker and customer. There was a very famous copyright lawyer who Mary Beth and I knew very, very well, as others in the audience did. One of the great copyright lawyers, probably had more impact on the evolution of the Copyright Act of 1976 than anyone named Irwin Carr, who was a great general counsel of the Authors League. And Irwin said, what conceivable difference does it make to copyright owners whether you have one pirate making 100,000 copies, that was a big distribution, and sending them out to 100,000 people, or whether you have 100,000 individuals each making one unauthorized copy for their own use. The economic impact upon the copyright owner and ultimately upon the entertainment and education system in this country is identical. And that's why one thing we haven't talked about, this whole notion that technology makes private use possible, and private uses are exempt from copyright. Doesn't make any sense. So again, I keep falling back on the notion that these are very complex and very difficult problems, but they're much easier to state than solve. And the solution that you just throw up your hands and walk away just doesn't make any sense. hasn't before, and it shouldn't again.
Right. Well, Mary Beth, finally, I mean, all that experience in the office that you had, can you give us some wisdom? John, we have to pay for his wisdom, but for you... But for you...
You remember what I said.
That's right. But for you, Mary Beth, we have you here with us today, and I want to ask you about your wisdom with regard to establishing that balance that we seem to be talking about here between copyright and innovation, between consumers and copyright holders, between the need to have access to information, to generate progress and to promote knowledge for the public good, and to be able to incentivize authors. Is there some way you think we can get to that point?
Two letters. No. Actually, the only thing I was going to say is we've heard that the courts are acting, and that will lead to something. Congress will act at some point, but I'm not sure when or how. One of the things that John mentioned and Tim mentioned, too, is that if you are a copyright owner and you recognize people who are causing you concern, you can try to work out deals. John talked about how publicly the motion picture company was screaming with regard to the technology companies about colorization. And yet they sat down and they worked on a solution. You talked about your material just being wholesale, made available, but you worked out a way where they were going to basically lead it back to your website. I know I was speaking at a Copyright Society meeting earlier, and a motion picture company were talking about YouTube and mashups. And Warner Brothers said, look, we do not want to be sending a notice and takedown issue about everything. And so we need to work with YouTube, and we need to work with all the people who are players to figure out, and for us, it's what is commercially harming us and what is not. And it's not really whether it's an infringement or it's fair. It's what commercially is killing us that you can't do and what we as a company can tolerate. And I do think in the next couple of years there will be some productive attempts at trying to come to resolutions in different types of industry that may put a Band-Aid on while some of the congressional work and some of the works in courts may be going forward.
Well, we look forward to seeing their prediction come true. I want to thank Mary Beth Peters, John Baumgarten, Tim Jacoby for their wit and wisdom today. Thank you all very much indeed. And now we'd like to turn it over to you. If you're watching us in an office or at home on our streaming site at copyright.com, you can tweet a question to @copyrightclear. So we hope you will do that. And if you're here in the audience at the museum on Pennsylvania Avenue, you're welcome to join us at the microphone stand right there and ask your question. If you have a question specifically for any of the panelists, please let me know that. But first, I want to turn to my colleague Craig Sender and see if we've got some tweets out there and what they're asking.
We actually do have a question via Twitter. It seems legislation is always catching up to new media. How can copyright owners maintain their ownership more fully? This is for the panel.
Well, we've been chatting about that a lot. And I guess, Tim, you live this every day. I mean, there are people like you trying to keep up with those kind of threats. At the same time, there's people in the newsroom trying to create new and imaginative ways of doing it. You guys must be working more closely than you ever have before.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. You know, we have people in the newsroom and people throughout the company certainly self-policing and trying to, pretty much find their stories on the web. We get a lot of self-reports from the newsroom that way. I think copyright enforcement and protecting our copyright ownership has become a tiny part of the job of everybody that works in the company, pretty much. I mean, you get information throughout the company about what's going on. But it's really, it's whack-a-mole in large part. And whack-a-mole is not productive. It's very, we had an instance last week where we found out that, a little website that looked quite legitimate was publishing full text copies of some of our stories. We figured out So first, before you go after anybody, you know, first you have to figure out, well, maybe they have permission in the first place. So we ultimately went through a series of about four contracts dating back about 12 years and discovered, and then also in talking to the site, that in fact they did have permission to republish this one full text copy of our story. So we're always on the lookout, but it's not necessarily a productive or efficient use of time to be operating that way.
And Mary Beth, I mean, copyright shouldn't be a burden to the copyright holder, should it?
Well, in a way, enforcement is the copyright owner's responsibility, unless it's criminal. So, yes, there's a benefit, but from my perspective, if you care about your property, then you're going to have to do some things to protect it.
Right, if you care about your house, you lock the door and that kind of thing. Right. Do we have any other questions?
We actually have a comment from Twitter. Sure, more people are content creators, but does that really mean almost everyone cares about copyright?
John, you were writing laws for copyright in 1976. Who cared then?
The creators cared.
Anybody else at that
many,
point?
Many user interests cared, represented by libraries and educators, for example. There was not a widespread mass consumer interest, but I think there were spots of it, and there were people who did talk to them. There were economic experts. I always put a quotation mark around economic expert. It's a habit. who purported to speak for consumer interests. But the mass consumer upswing. But I have to quarrel a bit with something you said earlier about I can't sit here agreeing with everybody. That would be no fun. That everybody is now a copyright owner. Literally, it's always been true. It's always been, before 1976, I mean, I wasn't there when the Copyright Act of 1910, even Mary Beth wasn't there when the Copyright Act. But I don't think.
That was 1710, in 1909. Okay.
Neither. The 1909.
We have to keep our centuries straight.
People have always created, and it's pretty much been copyrighted. If you didn't do anything publicly with it, you had what we used to call common law copyright. It's not so much, I think it's much more what's happened today is more people are using than the fact that they're creating. And using it in the sense of not just singing a song to yourself, but using it for public exposure, the mashup culture. You know, the mashup culture is great. I love some of that stuff. But, you know, the million-dollar investments in motion pictures or software isn't being done by people mashing up. It's being done by people investing immense sums of money, supporting strong employment bases and coming out with innovative products. And it's done with rules. And they seem to survive. And I think all users are going to have to deal with rules.
Well, you were talking about the people who cared in 1976, the educational institutions, the libraries, and Mary Beth was nodding vigorously. You remember that, too, and I know that's a great interest of yours. Talk about that.
The interest in libraries and educators? Well, I started my life as a school teacher, and I always worked in the library. But other than that, those education and libraries, their roles are changing, and they're facing digital issues, too. But they have, from the beginning, been players because there are people who write, and as John knows better than anyone, works that are, the primary market is the education market, and that still has to be protected. Libraries, their role is changing, and they're serving different purposes. We have an exemption in the United States, Section 108, for libraries that is outdated. And we've spent money and time and a lot of people, 20-plus people, put together a report on big picture and what changes are needed in order to appropriately balance, let me underline balance, what an exemption should look like. And the people who are on the committee
could basically agree with basic principles, and I will share with you, that when you get down to the nitty-gritty about what something should look like, a lot of that agreement falls away. So I'm not sure. We hear that internationally they've been working on exemptions for the blind, but now they're looking at exemptions for libraries and education. So the appropriate balance in a country's law or international treaties is front and center. Well, but I think it's going to be very difficult to move forward and get agreement.
Well, it seems like we have a pretty active Twitter sphere here. So, Craig, if you could read us the next question there.
Yes, we certainly do. This is a two-part question for Tim. What is the difference between the burdens of companies with the theft by rogue sites? How does that make the former harder? And what does that say about the need to address rogue sites?
Rogue sites and the need to address them. What's the Washington Post take and the newspaper industry's take on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important. We do need to address them. You know, I think we need to address, and I think we, you know, we need to address sites that are built upon, you know, basically make their money off of infringing other people's content, or that's a significant part of what they do. You know, again, it really comes back to, and I really like what Mary Beth said, actually. You know, I think that the critical issue is what's commercially killing us? And if you're a site that's out there infringing, making money, that your economic business model is to make money off of other people's content at a you know, detriment to the content creator, you know, like us that spends hundreds of millions of dollars investing in that content in the first place, that's a really big problem.
Right. And I think the bill that's about to be introduced or is being introduced, in fact, has a series of standards that must be met to qualify someone as a rogue site. So this isn't just simply slapping a label on someone.
Yeah, and that's important to us. You know, and coming back to the first question you asked me about balancing speech and copyright protection, because, you know, you do want to be careful about restricting speech in general and any kind of legislation that's going to clamp down on you know, different, and even aggregation, right? And that's why, you know, you do need to have appropriate standards in there for what's a rogue site and what isn't.
Right. Great. We have a question from the audience. Please step up.
Yes. My name is Ellen Savian. I work at the Association of Corporate Counsel, but in the evenings I teach sports law at George Washington University. And the students, when I get to the IP section of my course, I actually use the video off of the Copyright Clearance Center. That is a really wonderful, fun video teaching. And their faces begin to turn white as we, when I look into the audience and I say, so how many of you are not violating copyright? And not, but Professor Xavian, we're not, but they are. And so I'd like to take the conversation a little bit back saying, these kids are 20-something, they know nothing about copyright, they are about to go into an industry that is functions around licensing and images and so forth. Where is the education? It's enough to say we can litigate, we can get to Congress, we can go to law school, but if the users, the 13 to 24 bracket, are not understanding even the concept or I don't care attitude, I think that's the fault of the education system as well. And I was interested to see what your comments are.
As a former teacher and as a former registrar of copyrights, what about education?
I think there are many people trying to educate. And I know that a number of industries have tried to educate. You cited the Copyright Clearance Center. I know that even school systems have parts of the curriculum that even address that. I don't think we've found a successful way to do it. The United Kingdom seems to have done it better than we do. They have it as part of a civics course. I do a lot of teaching. And I teach at do some at GW, but at other law schools. I don't have a great answer, and maybe together we can work something out. I know that the record company had pretty good education and people got it, and there was a lot of emphasis on grades, you know, when they're young. They see their parents doing stuff, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But they realized that
it's sort of, even if they did that and they sort of got it when they became teenagers, sort of went away. And I don't know, it's sort of like now I'm doing it and I have changed. I think that maybe that's one of our greatest challenges is how do we educate people to, because they are creators and they are users, to appreciate the values. And I don't have an answer, and I try, and I do a lot of teaching. And I get through sometimes, but I don't know that it ever holds. So I'm looking at either one of you that adds to it.
Right. Well, I was thinking, Tim, I mean, now that's another job the Washington Post has to have.
Yeah. I'm, I guess, a little skeptical about education being solution here. I think, you know, we haven't really talked about this. This is a, you know, as a solution to the problem. But to me, a big part of the solution to the problems caused by technology, you know, will come or should come from technology itself. I mean, I think part of the reason that things have got, I'm no expert by any means on the music industry, but I think part of the reason that it's in a better place now is because, you know, technology is now available. I mean, iTunes does phenomenally well. Technology is available and easy, and it's a great business model and a great user experience to just, you know, I don't think people necessarily stop to think, am I infringing when I listen to or copy or download a piece of music online? They're just going through the best and easiest business model and best user experience. And so I think part of the solution to the copyright problem for us on the web, the infringement problem and on digital, I think has to come from there, you know, being technology that prevents people from just lifting our content wholesale without going through some sort of a mandatory or at least, you know, better process.
And licensing systems like the iTunes model as well.
Right, absolutely. Right.
Yep. We have a question.
It took 20 years to get the Copyright Act of 1976 informed to be adopted. Can you envision a process starting now that could get a new Copyright Act of 2031 that might actually work for everybody?
And we've been talking a lot about the potential for reform. But do we all have enough time?
And if you
it
did.
It actually took 60 years.
60 years.
It did.
No, the first sums were appropriated for the first studies 60 years earlier, not 20. So will you give us a 60-year?
Do we have time? I mean, there's a lot at stake right now, and there's a lot of arguments that go against copyright enough to make you worried about it.
I think maybe a process could start, but a lot of work needs to take place, and there has to be buy-in from Congress that there really should be a process. In both the 1909 law and the 1976 Act, that task was given to the Copyright Office. I raised it in a lecture, and I said, should it be the Copyright Office? And the audience shouted no. So I don't know where it begins, but it really is an iterative process where you really have to come to the grips that change going forward is necessary. It will take time. We have to identify issues. Who's going to be part of the dialogue? Is Congress going to buy in? It's a long process. So there have to be a lot of people coming forward from wide range of interests saying, this is something that we're willing to put the time and energy in, and Congress is willing to do that, and there's money to do that in order to move something like that forward.
Well, we have an audience here at the museum, an audience online that probably shares your interest in getting something started. So thank you again for that. I want to let everybody know finally that today's program was produced and presented by the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center. You can follow Copyright Clearance Center on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and learn much more about our educational services and licensing programs at our website, copyright.com. Thank finally again our panel, Tim Jacoby, John Baumgarten, and Mary Beth Peters. My name is Chris Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for joining us today.